Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Rick Moody, whose latest novel is Hotels of North America. Earlier novels include The Diviners, The Ice Storm, The Four Fingers of Death. There are 9 books of fiction, 2 books of nonfiction, and 1 collection in there as well. This particular book, as opposed to the last couple of novels, is a much smaller book. And I guess after the last 2 books, you wanted to write something that was a little bit more compact, or did it just turn out that way?
Well, there were some complaints in some quarters about excessive length with Four Fingers of Death. I mean, normally, from my point of view, that's a reason to go longer. You know, so I could have written the 1,600 pager, but a significant change in circumstances resulted in brevity, and that significant change in circumstances is a child. So the child got in the way of my garishly long books.
Let's talk about Hotels of North America, then I'd like to talk a little about your career as a whole. This particular book, as with all of your work, comes at the novel from a different angle. Each of your books does, and sometimes they're mashups, sometimes they're books within books. This particular book presents itself as a series of online reviews of hotels and motels and parking lots scattered around the United States and the world. Did it begin because on book tours you go to hotels, or did it begin because the voice of Reginald Edwin Moss was so strong?
It began because of a hotel mishap. I actually started a more conventional novel in 2009, and I wrote 250 pages of it, and I had a fit of hatred for its conventionality. I just sort of came up against a wall and felt that this book didn't reflect what I thought was happening in culture and happening around me. And my wife, who travels a lot, had taken me with her to a business trip, a business stop for her in Bergen, Norway. Beautiful town, can take the tram right up to the mountains, totally great. Except we were in the most god-awful hotel. It was really bad. They had, you know, house music Fridays and Saturdays, and you could hear the boonch, 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 boonch going for like 4 or 5 hours each night, well past when one might go to bed. So we were having a rotten time there. And my wife said to me one day, we should just review this hotel. And it had never occurred to me before, actually. I had never really read online reviews. I studiously avoided Amazon, lest I should stumble upon reviews of my own work or a bad review of Moby Dick or something. So I ignored all of that. But then once she suggested that I review this hotel, it's as if a light bulb went off and I thought, why shouldn't I make a novel out of those, you know? So off I went. And Reginald Morse's voice just became, you know, the way to do it. I had to have a guy who was writing these reviews, and his voice asserted itself early in the process.
At that point, you have to have some kind of plan. Did you chart out Morse's life before you began?
It seems so logical when you put it that way. Yeah, one must have a plan. I mean, that's how you're supposed to do this stuff, right? And yet, I had no plan. I mean, the way I went at it was, I would just get up in the morning and start a hotel review. And because I have this daughter who's getting in the way of everything, you know, I would just have little chunks of time in which to work. So each chapter, as it were, had to fit into the available space, you know. So I'd just sit down and I'd fire off President City Inn, Quincy, Mass, you know, and get a draft of it. And I wrote maybe 50 or 60 pages more than wound up in the book. There are a dozen or more other reviews that landed on the cutting room floor because as I went on, I began to see that a plan would have been the right approach, and I started trying to retrofit it with some backstory, and then I cut reviews that didn't have enough story in them.
So as it formed, you suddenly went, wait a second, okay, so these are reviews taking place in different years, but the chronology of when the reviews are published is the chronology of the book.
Yeah.
So we are telling the story out of sequence of Reginald's life.
Indeed. I mean, it became really important at a certain point to get timeline software so that I could graph where he was at various points, because I was just sort of making up the dates at first, which was turned out to be a crazy approach. And then I also made a timeline of when he published individual reviews. So it all ultimately got charted out kind of rigorously. But as is sometimes the way with me, it started with improvisation, and then there was a desperate push in the direction of organization.
Did that happen also with the Diviners or Four Fingers?
I mean, Four Fingers, I kind of knew what I was doing because it maps onto this really bad horror movie from the mid-60s called The Crawling Hand. So I was kind of trying to follow the plot structure of The Crawling Hand. But The Diviners was pretty improvised in terms of its structure, definitely collage-oriented.
So what you do is you start and go, okay, I'm going to go there and see where it goes. And if you reach 250 pages and you go, this isn't interesting enough, you put it aside.
Well, I'd never put that much aside before. It's kind of terrifying to put 250 pages aside, you know, when you get paid to make these things. But I did in this case, and it was a real philosophical quandary because it had to do with what is the novel meant to be and what is the novel meant to be now, you know. Does naturalism, does a sort of American naturalism of the early 20th century variety still speak to who we are and what's happening? You know, I sort of feel like a more fragmentary, higher velocity, eruptive form gets American life now in a more honest, genuine way.
Sound a lot like David Shields when you say that.
Maybe he's out there listening, but he knows that I've teed off on him a lot recently, so that's quite a comparison.
Well, having interviewed him and heard similar elements about how what he calls the big baggy novel is dead, what you're saying is that the old-fashioned big bagging novel is dead.
I mean, I don't know if it's the bigness and the bagginess for me. It's realism. I mean, I have a quarrel with realism.
Why?
Because what does it mean? There's a certain kind of epiphanic story model. Let's say it's based on, these days, Robert McKee's ideas about story structure in Hollywood, because I think it is, okay, like a sort of a three-act structure. If the rugged individualist with epiphanic moment in the third act story structure has become a formula, which
right,
I sort of think it has, then there's nothing new that really suggests the pace and style of lived life.
The old adage, of course, is, you know, introduction, whatever in the middle section, and then conclusion. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl.
I feel like if that's my job, then my job is, you know, it's like a service sector position. I might as well be making hamburger patties in a way.
But on the other hand, people have been avoiding that structure for years now.
I think the initial date of the avoidance is 1921, so almost 100 years. Yeah, they have. You know, in a way, a postmodernist would tell you that that approach, the make it new approach, is just as tired and careworn. But I know of no other way. That's the way in my heart, the make it new way.
On the other hand, when you've read too many, I was a big mystery fan, and suddenly I'm reading mysteries and I'm going, oh, damn, there's got to be a dead body somewhere. I'm tired of this.
Yeah. I mean, mysteries are a real example of the crisis that I'm talking about in a way. You want them to be that formulaic up to a point, because it has a job to do, and the job is to present the dead body and then solve the mystery, you know. But I feel like literary novels should not be that oversimplified. They shouldn't be that explicable.
So where do you put someone like Jonathan Franzen?
I mean, that's a long conversation. He made a dialectic between what he called the status novel and the contract novel.
Right.
In a famous essay he wrote about William Gaddis. And in that essay, the contract novel is the novel that sees itself as owing something to the reader and creating an accessible pathway for the reader to get into the work, you know. I never feel that way about it. I feel like I like a challenging book. I happen to love William Gaddis, for example. So the denigrated status novels that he refers to, of which I think he would have said David Wallace was one, perhaps, you know, those turn out to be books that I feel passionately about, you know. So I'm not worried about my work being considered in that light.
So what put you on the path of a novel that was more standardized before you turned to Hotels of North America?
Well, what did put me on that path? I mean, I had written a bunch of comic novels. There are two of them sitting here on your console. And I sort of thought I should stop joking around. And the reason I thought that is because I think, generally speaking, the literary community thinks that comic writing is a second-order species.
You think so? I mean, James Joyce is a comic writer.
True.
Nabokov was a comic writer.
I know, but you're talking about work from 50 or 100 years ago. I mean, if you look at what sort of seizes the day in the last 20 years, give me an example of a comic novel that's achieved total market dominance. Not that that's the way to assess, but just for the sake of the conversation.
Well, Pynchon.
Maybe, but he's a guy who got established in, you know, the early 60s.
You mean more recently?
Yeah. I mean, Pynchon's the exception to the rule. Maybe sometimes Don DeLillo, the Don DeLillo of White Noise or Cosmopolis, you know. But even he, DeLillo's in a position now where he's a bit of an underdog, you know. So anyway, I thought, hey, maybe I should stop telling so many jokes. Maybe I should try, you know. So I came up with this deadly earnest story. Do you want to know what the deadly earnest story was?
Sure.
NPR producer goes to Baghdad at the end of the war, end of the war being in quotation marks, and happens to be at the site of a roadside bombing, gets a bad TBI, comes back to Washington, attempts to put his life back together. It seems so earnest, right? I mean, it's so American, it's so earnest. But I just felt like I didn't know who the guy was. I did all this research. I had lunch with people from NPR to try to figure out what his job was and everything. And I wrote all this work about his life, and I just felt like I knew nothing about him. I had no passion for his predicament.
So he was kind of an empty shell, and you couldn't fill the shell.
I couldn't fill him up with a real person, and it was because I was suppressing the comic.
Well, you have to be who you are.
That's right. If I have to create scenes of low comedy, then I just have to create them.
Which brings us back to Hotels of North America. It's fiction, but you do delve into various areas and scams of being in a hotel. Did you do research on it?
You mean, are you referring to the strategic placement of dead cockroaches?
The sneaking out in the middle of the night?
Yeah. I have not done all those things personally. I've not secreted away dead cockroaches in my possessions in order to strategically place them. But I asked around a little bit what people do. Yeah, I mean, it's realistic to that extent.
Rick Moody, are any of these hotels and Hotels of North America real hotels?
What does that mean to you? Do you mean are the addresses exact, or did
yeah.
I actually stay in that yeah. particular one?
Could I go on a tour of Rick Moody's novel, Hotels of North America, including the IKEA parking lot?
Up to a point, you could. You definitely could go to the IKEA parking lot in New Haven. You could go to the plaza. I mean, some of them, if they were particularly scurrilous, I changed addresses and I fused together franchises with other franchises. Although the legal department, when they read the book, said, far better for you to make a deluxe strength disclaimer on the copyright page than to change the addresses. So, in fact, I made a very deluxe disclaimer. It's beautifully written. It's at the top there.
Hotels of North America is a work of fiction Persons and places in the book are either fictional or are used fictionally. In particular, opinions about hotels contained in Hotels of North America do not represent the opinion of the author or the publisher at all, but are rather the opinions of a desperate, disgruntled, and wholly fictional hotel reviewer named Reginald E. Morse. There is no evidence whatsoever that he strode the earth, harrowing hotel and motel employees with his unrestrained and tragicomic invective. Of course, there is an afterword which indicates that perhaps these are real, but that's part of the comic.
Yeah.
When you were working on this, how much did Reginald take over in the sense that we know, of course, you're writing the book, but there's a certain point where stuff just starts to pour out and takes you in directions you didn't expect. Did that happen?
I think so. I mean, I feel in a way it's sort of silly to get into the business of quantifying these things, but in a way I feel like Reginald is the most complete character I ever sketched out. And it may be because often in the past I started with setting and social milieu, and then I would people it sort of after the fact, like in the ice storm. I knew that I was in Fairfield County, and I knew I was in the early 70s, and I knew that adultery was the sort of thematic arc. And then I kind of outfitted it with people to get to that place. But with this book, there's no place. The place is the absence of place. It's every place. It's franchise America broadly construed. So I had to get the guy first. And because I got the guy first, he kind of walked away with the book. He made it his own voyage of discovery, you know.
There's also his, well, his wife doesn't really have much of a character, but his girlfriend Kay does.
Yeah.
I would assume that she just poured out and suddenly there was this other character.
Yeah, it's exactly like that, really. Yeah. She has frequently changed pet names that are all various species of North American birds, perhaps a little in-joke, in honor of Laurie Moore for having a title similar to my title. But yeah, once I discovered Kay, Kay became an integral part of the book. It's really a love story in my view.
About halfway through the book, and I'm not really giving too much away, we find out he has a daughter. At the moment he said he had a daughter, was that when you first found out he had a daughter?
I think I knew chronologically before I had that scene, but not that much before I had that scene. I mean, I sort of knew that I wanted him to be keeping a secret from his reading public. And then I wanted the online trolls to sort of try and smoke him out a little bit. And it's possibly the case that I chose that for the secret because I have experience with the subject.
What's the relationship between your life coach section of your webpage and the trolls? Is there any?
I think that the life coach stuff is recast in Hotels of North America as Reginald's career as motivational speaker. And I think those two things are definitely related. Now that I'm doing my life coach stuff, I've become, you know, I feel empowered. And so I gave him the motivational speaker job because it seemed related to what I was doing.
One other element of Hotels of North America is, of course, the Internet and the changes that have occurred in how we deal with life with the Internet. So I guess on some level, a more serious element is the relationship of our life to the Internet. Was that in the back of your mind at all?
I mean, that was in the front of my mind, yeah. I had this conversation with my NYU students a couple of weeks ago. I teach a graduate writing workshop there right now. And I said, students, the Internet is where humanism goes to die. And they're all in their 20s, and they took issue with this remark. And we sort of got into it a little bit, you know. And I knew that I was provoking for the sake of it a little bit, but I also wanted to make a point about the way in which isolation, estrangement are sort of a bedrock condition in the language of the internet. It's always some kind of yearning for connection that begins in a spot of estrangement, or so it seems to me. And all this online reviewing that's happening out there on Yelp and Amazon is all happening from that spot. You know, when some teenager hits post on the chop job that she's going to do on Moby Dick, what a boring book. You know, she's doing it from the solitary confines of her bedroom, you know. I wanted the book to try to suggest, you know, that there are pulsations of complexity and actual human feeling underneath that troll-like behavior somewhere. I wanted to try to get to that.
Yet at the same time, the afterword takes on a new meaning from what you said, which is that when you go looking for this Reginald person, he becomes completely elusive. We don't even know if he exists.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. And in a way, that's a sort of allegory for the kinds of subjectivities that the internet throws up. You never know who they are. We don't know half the time who a jumble of letters and numbers is who's posting, you know, hate mail about Hillary Clinton or whomever. We don't know at that time. And going in search of those people seems to turn up more clues but no definitive answer some of the time.
Yeah, I've been on a couple of chat discussions which get ugly, and it's hard to avoid getting ugly with them unless you want to withdraw completely.
Yeah.
Which, of course, gives the other person the final word.
Yeah, indeed.
But when you go searching, what you find, say, on Facebook is nothing. You can't get a grasp on it. Then you Google the person, and maybe there's one mention from 2012. But does that person even exist? You don't even know.
Yeah. I mean, that to me is sort of what internet search ultimately tends toward. You studied philosophy, so you probably know that in continental philosophy there's this idea of unlimited semiosis. Signifiers only refer to other signifiers, and you can never get to the actual content. Well, in a way, that's meant to be the afterword here.
Does this change how you look at, say, what America has become in the context of your earlier novels?
You know, I don't look at them anymore. I don't think about them anymore. It could be that you could make a different interpretation of those works in light of what's happened now. But I would tend to think of them all as stepping stones in a journey of thinking about what the novel can do and what fiction can do. And I feel at least today, at this point on the journey of being abroad in the world with Hotels of North America, like I made a coherent, slightly better organized example of pushing the novel forward than I did, let's say, in Four Fingers of Death.
Rick Moody, what the novel can do. I mean, this comes up as I look at your website. What do you see, in 30 words or less, the novel can do?
I mean, I think the novel has no prevailing shape. It can have any shape that it wants to have.
Right.
And it can subsume any medium that it wants to subsume. Did you ever read W.G. Sebald, the German writer?
Yeah.
A total fave of mine. You know, and his work uses photographs with such creativity. You know, so clearly the novel is the magpie form. It can be anything. It can steal anything. And it can speak to the sort of heterogeneity of American culture as a whole. America is not one thing.
Right.
It's an innumerable number of things and subcultures and inclinations. What do we refer to when we refer to America? We don't even know, you know. And I think that the form could be better reflective of that in a way.
You think it's been tied down by the publishers then?
Tied down by market forces. Yeah, a little bit, I do.
Well, the question is, what kind of an audience? Doesn't a novel need an audience, or does it?
Well, it needs an audience, but the question is, of what size does that audience need to be? I mean, if you're willing to sort of be patient and have a highly cultivated readership, we happy few, as Stendhal said about about the literary audience, then who cares? If it's going to be Coffeehouse Press or Grey Wolf or University Press audience, what's wrong with that?
Well, then, of course, you move into the realm of an author attempting to be an author full-time rather than having to take up another job. I mean,
they're all taking up other jobs. They're all taking up the academic other job, by and large. What is it? It's probably 0.5% of writers who can make a living off of just their fiction these days.
And the rest of it are what they call the mid-list.
Yeah.
Let's go back and talk a little about your career. You went to Brown University, and then there was a long break before you went back to school and got your MFA?
No. In fact, there was virtually no break.
Okay.
I took 1 year off where I lived here, San Francisco, California, and then I went back 1 year later to Columbia, which was
a
regrettable move.
Why?
I mean, I think my theory is that the writing workshop works best if mentorship is a part of how it does what it does. And that's a feature in undergraduate writing workshops. Often I was lucky enough to have a teacher who was a powerful presence in the classroom and someone that we worked toward. I mean, I had among my classmates, Jeff Eugenides, four or five other writers who've gone on to publish. And all of us so loved this guy, John Hawks, that we were studying with, that we sought out the sort of paternal acclaim in that workshop. But my grad workshop experience was just the opposite. I mean, Columbia was sort of a technocrat's dream of an art school. You know, people clocked in and clocked out, and the workshop was based on demonstrable result and never really the messy, complex stuff of humans striving to get better. So for me, I was too young, I wasn't ready, I shouldn't have been there, it was the wrong school, etc.
Did you always want to write?
I always wrote. I did some other things, but writing always happened alongside.
Rick Moody, in The Black Veil, you talk about going downhill pretty quickly with alcoholism. And that was occurring around the same time as...
After I got out of grad school was where that sort of reached its peak.
Were you doing any writing during that period?
Yeah, I wrote. I wrote badly. I mean, if you read my not very good first novel, it's in two parts, Garden State, it's called. And you can, I think anyway, clearly see that part one was written by an alcoholic and part two is written by a newly sober person.
And after that, when you came back out of it, how did you get back into writing?
Well, it was kind of hard. It was hard at first, in part because I had written while drinking quite a bit in grad school, for example, and in the time after grad school. So I had to relearn writing habits, you know. I had this time that I always worked, and it began like at 4:30, and I always kept bourbon next to the typewriter. I was writing on the IBM Selectric 2 typewriter, and I would write until I had double vision. That was my day's trajectory, you know. And once I was unable to read what I was doing, then I would stop, you know. So when I began writing after not drinking anymore, I had to come up with a completely different way of working, you know. Started writing first thing in the morning for a while. Music became a big part of the work then. I wrote with music on. Choosing music for whatever I was working on became part of the way I did it. I had productivity goals for every day. And so I had to kind of create an environment in which work could happen that was not related to the carnage.
Well, you were also a musician. Mm-hmm. So were you playing, what do you play, guitar?
And keyboards, and I sing a little bit.
And so were you in a group at the time? Or?
No, you know, that's one thing that happened when I first got sober and I was working. I stopped doing music for a while. It was sort of like music was also a thing that I associated with excess, and I needed time to figure out how to do it in a way that wasn't sort of prurient, you know. So I started playing guitar then. I never had any lessons. But I just thought, oh, I'll teach myself, you know, one day at a time how to play this instrument. And then after sort of 5 or 7 years of doing that, that's when I kind of crawled out of my shell and I started playing with people again.
And now you compose and you play music publicly then?
Yeah, a little bit.
In 2002, Dale Peck called you the worst writer of his generation. And in 2008, you pied him.
I pied him. So true. Yeah.
Let me ask you then, because you've gotten into trouble with your own music reviews. Taylor Swift, is it?
Yeah.
What do you think about criticism and reviews in the sense that the difference between criticism, say, and hawking an opinion?
First, I should say that I pied Dale Peck for charity. I did not wait 6 years and then hit him with a pie. And he was a really good sport about it. In fact, the pie-throwing incident involved people giving money, and for every $100 I would get, I can't remember, 6 inches closer to Dale, you know. And then at some point, a rich guy wrote a big check, and basically I was as far from him as I am from you right now. So throwing the pie was really easy. I just kind of went smush.
Was it fun?
Well, it was fun, yeah, but it wasn't revenge. By that point, I was pretty much clear of any feelings about the whole thing. And I tried in public to studiously avoid comment on the whole thing. I felt like Dale's review was less about me and more about ideas that he had about the world and his own place in the world. And I wanted him to be able to resolve that narrative instead of me getting involved. So I didn't say anything about it, you know. And in fact, later on after the pie incident, I was approached to be on a panel about Thomas Bernhard, the Austrian writer. And I knew that Dale really liked Bernhard. So I said, why don't you put Dale on the panel, you know? So we're on it together. We both really liked this writer. We talked about it. It was totally civil. And at a certain point, and I apologize, Dale, for saying this in public, he came to me and he said, you've been a gentleman. And on that basis, I think of Dale as, you know, a fellow traveler and a colleague at this point. So from my point of view, that story ends well. That's a little parable or an allegory about unrestrained invective and where it gets you, you know. I try to use my powers for good, by and large, even in my music reviews. On one occasion, it is true, I used my powers for ill. And the only reason I did it really is because no one else would say anything on the subject. It was as if this one particular artist had a free pass. Even people who had, like Robert Christgau, let's say, you know, fairly advanced taste, yeah, seemed supportive of this work that I found thin. So I just said a few things about it, and I took a lot of body blows in response. I don't regret it, because I said what I had to say, but I still feel that criticism should be, it should be investigated with your whole heart, and it should be done in an environment in which you're reasoning carefully, and no stone should go unturned. And if you do all that, then perhaps you don't end up with invective.
I talked recently with John Lahr, and that's why I brought this up, is because we were talking about the difference between a review, which he said in his case, which is theater, is basically just retelling a plot, opinion, and criticism, because criticism goes underneath the surface,
yeah,
and analyzes and doesn't necessarily have to give an opinion other than the fact that on some level, everything from a writer, an honest writer, is going to have opinion there.
Yeah. I mean, I totally agree with that. I'm so made miserable by these book reviews that are plot reconstructions of a kind. I don't know what good that really does anybody, you know? And then on the other hand, you have a place like New York Review of Books or LA Review of Books where they're actually really trying to describe the experience of reading a book. I love reading that stuff, you know? And there are people in those pages who are occasionally pretty hard on a writer. But when they are, they often bulk out the criticism with actual reference to the text, you know? So you learn something along the way.
when getting those kinds of reviews, I mean, I can't imagine if somebody came out and said, you know, wrote online, you're the worst interviewer on the planet, you know, how would I respond? How do you respond?
Well, as I say, I didn't respond at all. What I knew was the sentence, Rick Moody's the worst writer of his generation, couldn't possibly be true. I mean, if you just take that sentence and try to evaluate it, it's just not true. I mean, I might be a writer that he doesn't like a lot, but I'm not the worst writer of my generation. I don't even know how you would test the hypothesis. I don't think it's testable. So in terms of it actually saying something, it doesn't say anything to me.
Which is why it's about him, not you.
Yeah.
Changing the subject, there's a lot of elements of science fiction in your work. Did you grow up reading science fiction?
I did.
Who were your favorites?
Well,
did you like Chip Delaney?
You know, I so admire Chip Delaney. I think Chip Delaney's like a national treasure. Yeah. I only read one book of his during my teen science fiction period, which was the book called Dahlgren. That's an incredible book, you know. I read a lot of Heinlein. I read a lot of classic Golden Age science fiction in the early 70s. The sort of narrative arc of that period was Heinlein, Asimov, Ray Bradbury, Kurt Vonnegut, Richard Brautigan, Thomas Pynchon. So at a certain point, that was how it went for me, and then I didn't want to read Heinlein or Arthur C. Clarke anymore. Then I really wanted to read Chip Delaney, and since then I've read J.G. Ballard and Philip K. Dick and, you know, sort of more literary science fiction writers, speculative fiction writers, with much delight. I'm still interested in that work.
There was also some bizarre controversy over the ice storm in Arizona. That's on Wikipedia?
Yeah, there have been a couple of censorship things with me. The ice storm, there was a censorship flap. I think some kid got assigned the ice storm in a class, and some of the childhood sexuality stuff, you know, there's sort of middle school sexuality in the ice storm, rubbed this kid the wrong way. His or her parents got involved. They went to their state senator, and this guy gave a speech, you know, about how I was smut, which I really hoped that that would sell 50,000 copies of The Ice Storm, but it didn't turn out that way.
There was also a very good movie made of The Ice Storm.
That's
you got
true.
Lucky.
I got very lucky, yeah, because I've been unlucky with other projects, but that one came out really well.
Have a lot of these books been...
No, there was a novella in the book called Demonology that got filmed. With
Personal Effects.
Yeah. Let's move on. Let's just move on.
When someone gets a movie made, you sort of have to kind of go, well, take the money and run.
Well, it's like the famous Ernest Hemingway line, which was, drive to the border of California, throw your book over the fence. When they throw the money back, take the money and drive home. Or words to that effect. And that's the model in which you should practice this adaptation thing.
Rick Moody, you made a comment in terms of the mutability of the novel, that it could be pretty much anything, and too much falls into the Hollywood three act. Do you think the same comment could be made about film or television?
I mean, would you not say that these have been great years for television?
Oh, yeah.
Television is just, in the last 10 years, has been rather extraordinary, I think. Cable, as a sort of open field, has just created so much great storytelling. So in a way, I would absent television from the discussion right now, but I think film's in a very bad place. And the period of film that I liked, well, let's say there were two periods. One was the foreign film boom of the late 60s and 70s, and the American auteur reaction to that that brought us to The Godfather and the early Scorsese films, etc. What a great period, right? And then the second period was the independent film movement of the 90s, through which we had Soderbergh and Spike Jonze and Charlie Kaufman and that kind of stuff. also a great period. But whatever the funding mechanism was that made that possible, we're not in that world of capitalism anymore. And right now, Marvel Comics is driving Hollywood, and that's all we have. We have CGI, and we don't have ideas about character or ideas about form in the way that we did 20 years ago. Little things here and there, but it's just not, doesn't seem to me to be happening.
But on the other hand, I look at it and I go, well, it may not be that bad a thing because it got Soderbergh to do the Nick.
Well, that's true. And the Nick, yeah, I mean, but that goes back to the whole television argument.
Right. It's not as if the impetus for great work has dried up. It's just moved into a different environment.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? So, and we don't even know where that's going. That's still on some level in its infancy.
Yeah. I mean, it could be moving on to the web if you buy the idea that Transparent, for example, is pretty much a web-related product, and it's a great show. It could be that filmmaking could happen in some far more democratized environment where they don't need the studios at all, or the television.
Well, on the same level with books, you now have e-books that you could put anything out as well.
Yeah.
So you don't need that either.
I mean, all we need is some kind of modulating threshold that directs us through the vast amount of material to books that we might want to read.
And that brings us back to your role as a critic, I guess.
Or Reginald Morse's role as a critic. Although I don't know that I would definitely read a book if he said to read it. I'm not sure we should trust him.
Well, certainly I would trust him about the final hotel that he's in the Bronx.
The Capri Whitestone. You yes. must know it. It's right near where you grew up.
Well, every time I went over the Whitestone Bridge, there was the Whitestone Cinemas
yeah.
in the Bronx,
yeah.
which are now gone.
Are gone.
Which are now gone.
But that's exactly where Capri Whitestone was. It, too, is closed now. But it was
I
right
remember
in that,
that
spot. Yeah.
It's it was a real motel.
Yeah. It's a classic, go there, you know, do 3 ounces of cocaine with your prostitute kind of hotel, unfortunately.
Rick Moody, what are you working on now?
Some stories and a new volume of memoir.
You've been listening to an interview with Rick Moody, whose latest novel is Hotels of North America. I'm Richard Walensky on Bookwaves.